I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers online courses to the public through partnerships with leading universities internationally. Coursera was launched in 2012 and reached its first 1 million users faster than Facebook or Twitter. Coursera is one of a number of companies offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that had been launched in recent years to address a growing global population and the rising costs of on-campus higher education. Daphne is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are some specific features of a Coursera experience?
So the Coursera student experience is an attempt on our part to give to students all over the world an experience that is as close as possible that we can get to being on campus. The course starts on a given day. Every week the students are responsible for learning some content. There's homework that's due every week, which is graded. And if you don't do your homework, you don't get a grade and you don't pass the course. And then there's a rich social community of students around the course that are working together to help themselves deal with the challenges of this difficult material.
What is the age range of the people enrolled on the system?
We have students that are as young as 10 and students that are as old as 90. I got an email from an 86-year-old that tells us that she doesn't feel comfortable going to college because people are going to look at her funny. What's this old lady doing in class? And so she is taking a Coursera course and meets up with a bunch of other octogenarians every week in the public library to do a study group.
And how about internationally? You're touching students in several hundred countries.
We're touching students in every single country around the world. I mean, every single country that the State Department defines as a country has Coursera students in it. We have students in Iran, we have students in Pakistan, we have students in Ghana and Kenya and South Africa, students in Australia, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, China. I mean, you name it. So just a couple weeks ago, I got an email from the modern contemporary American poetry professor at Penn who told us about a student from Pakistan who had taken the course remotely and has done so well that it was part of his admissions package to Penn, and now he's coming to study at the University of Pennsylvania. We have a student from Peru who took a bunch of our computer science courses because there weren't a lot of computer science courses available to him in Peru, used that as the basis for his Fulbright application, and is now coming to study in the United States as a Fulbright scholar.
You co-founded the company with Professor Andrew Ng, who is also at Stanford. Stanford has a history of computer-assisted learning that, you know, dates back to, I'd say, the 1960s. Can you describe the nature of the computer-assisted learning?
Mm-hmm. So Stanford has a very long history of distance learning. It started out, I think, as you said, back in the 60s, where they were filming courses in class and then shipping literal video cassettes to local industry sites so that students could watch the video cassettes, and then they would mail in their homework and their graded homework would be mailed back to them. This is how long back this goes.
When you say students, these were students actually at local companies in Palo Alto, such as Intel.
That's right. These are students who are local or not even local. Some of them were in Oregon, for example.
And they were employees of these companies.
These were employees of these companies.
And Coursera is also videos of the professors, of the lectures, but it's much more interactive this time.
Well, that's one of the differences. But the other difference is that the lectures are not, by and large, lecture capture of what happens in a live classroom. These are videos that are prepared intentionally for online consumption. And that changes the student experience dramatically because once you move away from the constraints of in-class teaching, you have a lot more freedom. So first of all, you don't have to teach at 50-minute segments. You can teach at 8-minute segments that are much better suited to students' attention spans and to the granularity of the topics. You can also do things that are much more creative, like record some stuff in a workshop or out in the field, for example, making things much more alive to students.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers university-level online courses to the global public. When was the idea for Coursera hatched with you?
if you want to trace my history in Coursera, it actually goes way back before we even thought of Coursera. Yeah. I've been involved in teaching efforts at Stanford ever since I got there and have been interested in the use of technology in teaching all the way back to 2008 or 9, which is when a group of us were summoned to by Stanford administration to just discuss how students could become more engaged with their instructors at Stanford, how you can create more interaction. About 2 months after that meeting, I happened to be at a Google faculty summit where they bring faculty from all over the world to discuss ideas, and I was listening to a talk on YouTube, and it occurred to me that this provided a medium by which we could create really high-quality course content that could be presented to students outside the classroom with a lot of additional engagement beyond just the lecture. And then when students came into class in that precious time when the students and the faculty were actually in the same room at the same time, you could actually talk to each other and do stuff together. Problem solving, creativity, case studies, things like that that we never have time to do in real classes. And for me, that was the first step that eventually morphed into Coursera a few years after that.
Your co-founder, Professor Andrew Ng, also came to online education through his own personal experience. What was that briefly?
So Andrew, back in 2007-2008, started a project that was aimed to take some of Stanford's great content and make it available to the many people who are not privileged enough to have access to Stanford quality education. And so he created a project called Stanford Engineering Everywhere, which took 10 of Stanford's most popular engineering classes, cleaned them up, and put them up on the web for everyone around the world to make use of.
Incidentally, SEE, or Stanford Engineering Everywhere, has reached over 1 million people at this point.
I think it's that effort combined with some of the ideas that I developed in the context of my class at Stanford, that by combining these different ideas is how we arrived at a lot of the vision behind what turned into Coursera. And that really culminated in the fall of 2011 with a grand experiment that Stanford did in which it launched 3 courses and in computer science and made them open to everyone around the world for free. We were expecting an enrollment of a few thousand people in these courses. They were pretty advanced courses in computer science, but within weeks, each of them had an enrollment of 100,000 students or more. I think that that opportunity and the magnitude of it is what caused us to effectively put our respective careers on hold, and in my case, also my family on hold to a certain extent, and really walk into what has turned out to be an incredibly exciting but also time-consuming endeavor.
Were you and Andrew friends since you were in the same department? Or
actually, Andrew and I had been friends even before he joined Stanford. We even wrote a paper together while I was a very young faculty member at Stanford, and he was still finishing up his PhD at Berkeley.
Coursera has partnerships with Stanford, yes, and universities ranging from Princeton to the University of Pennsylvania to a Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And while Stanford's attitude towards using its content has been one of openness, there has been initial concerns about making the university's content available to the public. Some might feel, why should we offer content for free while students who attend our university are paying northwards of $40,000 a year? What do you think has made universities comfortable with adopting Coursera as a partner?
I think universities are realizing that this is a transformation that's coming, and it's coming regardless of whether they engage with us or not. And many universities feel like they would rather be helping to steer the train as opposed to sitting on the sidelines to see where it goes. At the same time, I think that most of the universities, I would argue all of the universities that are working with us, realize that their value proposition to their students is and had better be about more than just offering content. If content is about to become free and ubiquitous, then what they would like to do is to open up more time in the curriculum for this active engagement with students, which is really what distinguishes the best universities.
Right. It's going to have, this change is coming, and whether they want to be friendly to that and part of that and active agents rather than on the defense is what they're up against.
Online education, when we started doing this, was something that was looked upon with a certain amount of skepticism and even disdain by most institutions. And now it's something that every institution realizes that they're going to have to embrace in some form or another. So somebody told me something the other day that I think is very smart. They said that the term blended learning in 10 years is going to sound like the term horseless carriage. There's not going to be any other kind.
So it's not just launching a company, but you really are pioneering an industry to some extent.
I think we are helping to pioneer the first major transformation in the landscape of higher education since the invention of the printing press. If you look at medicine, for example, and you list all of the inventions that occurred in the last 200 years, there's a ton of them. There's antibiotics and orthoscopic surgery and anesthetics. I mean, you can list them and you have pages. What were the big inventions in education and in higher education in the last 200 years? You kind of scratch your head. Whiteboards versus blackboards? PowerPoint? I mean, there really is not very much on that list.
You have raised venture capital from Kleiner Perkins and NEA. And while you are a for-profit company, you certainly have a social mission. You are mindfully Coursera.org versus Coursera.com. Can you elaborate on that decision?
I think both Andrew and I are educators and went into this with the primary goal of offering education to everyone. We went into this as a for-profit company, partially because people told us it's if you're going to become sustainable, this is a way of doing it in a disciplined way. I'm not starting to rely on charitable foundations and encounter donor fatigue. And partly because that was our way of getting enough seed capital to get this going as a viable effort.
Now, regarding the business model, how do you see becoming profitable? Right now, you offer courses free.
Mm-hmm. Well, we intend to continue offering courses for free because once you start charging money, you block access to this to the people who need it the most, the people who can't afford even $5 or don't, in many cases, even have a credit card. So how do you make money if you don't charge for access? Well, so we have a couple of different directions that we're pursuing. One of those is charging for credentialing, and we've recently started to offer this notion of an authenticated credential where a student identifies themselves using a government-issued ID, and then every time that they submit work, they have a biometric profile that allows us to ensure that they are, in fact, participating in the learning process. This is not a super costly thing. You know, average is about $50 per course to participate in that, and we've had quite a good opt-in to that, and it's entirely optional. Second model, which we think is very interesting, is we've had a lot of institutions come to us and say, we would love to be able to offer this course to our students, but we don't have anyone to teach it. Can we take your course, adopt it, wrap around some instructor guidance and facilitation by an instructor who might not be an expert enough to prepare the course, but can still provide help to students as they make their way through it? And all of a sudden, our students are now able to graduate with a much richer transcript than they could before. That makes them much more marketable.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera. We'll hear more from Professor Koller coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers online courses to the public through partnerships with leading universities internationally. Daphne is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. You're charging a small fee for this verified certificate, but still that precludes a large percent of the population from taking the course. How are you addressing that?
So from day one, we told our engineers, this is not going out without a financial aid program. There's a student from Chile, for example, who, for family reasons, wants to study Huntington's disease, wants to do a PhD, and is taking our Minds and Synapses course so as to be able to improve their application and have a greater chance of being admitted to its PhD program. We have a student from Egypt, a doctor who is studying the nutrition class so that she can better serve the people of her community despite the fact that she gets no support from the Ministry of Health in Egypt. We have a student from Bangladesh who is taking our energy and sustainability course because he realizes only 53% of the citizens of his country have access to electricity, and he's hoping to be able to provide access to electricity to the other half of his country.
inherent in any companies getting off the ground are some problems early on, whether they're technical glitches or plagiarism in your case, or questions surrounding grading. You have adopted, in some circumstances, peer grading, where there's more subjectivity around a paper that might be submitted. A student has to grade four other papers, and it's anonymous, so they don't know who the participant is. Can you talk about just the nature of that decision?
There are certain types of work that currently computers just can't effectively grade, and that includes designs, for example. It includes essay questions that require deep thinking, causal reasoning, and so on. Computers just can't grade that right now, and certainly not provide useful feedback to the students. And since we wanted to support courses that require that kind of work, we put together this peer grading mechanism. Now, I agree that it's something that has to be designed very carefully. You can't just take a lay student who's learning the material for the first time and tell them, here's another paper, grade it. Mm-hmm. The instructor has to put a lot of thought into creating what we call a grading rubric, which defines the criteria by which a paper is supposed to be graded and how each of them is to be applied. And those have to be very carefully specified so that the student, even though they're not expert in the material, can take somebody else's paper and say, yes, these 3 points were made, and yes, these 5 references were given, and so on, so that they can provide a robust and reproducible grade for the work.
It's not perfect, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Excellent. Exactly so. And actually, let me add to that, that one of our professors from Princeton, Mitch Denier, actually tried out this notion of the perfect being the enemy of the good. He had 2 of his teaching assistants grade all of the final exams in his sociology course, and it was a hard final exam, and then compared the results from the TA grading to the results of peer grading, and they were very, very well correlated. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a very well-designed grading rubric, and of course, if the grading rubric is not well designed, this is not going to be as good. But for a well designed grading rubric, it's actually pretty darn good.
You mentioned Professor Mitch Denier. He's a sociology professor at Princeton, and he had 40,000 students take his course from over 100 countries. Can you provide more texture to his experience?
Yeah. So Professor Mitch Denier taught one of our earliest, in fact, arguably our earliest humanities course, because it was a very humanitarian sociology class, not a very quantitative one. And he tried this interesting experiment where, in addition to his weekly lecture materials, he also had a weekly video chat with 10 students selected from different countries around the world. So a student from Nepal, from India, from Georgia, the country, from South America. And he says that he learned more from one instance of teaching this class to a global audience than he learned from teaching it for 12 years at Princeton, because at Princeton, every year there is a great discussion, but it's very similar from year to year because the students have very similar backgrounds. Whereas here, in one go, he got such an amazingly broad range of different perspectives.
We alluded to this before, but can you provide more examples of the types of people taking the Coursera courses, from the traditional student to the octogenarian?
Sure. So our courses span the range of ages. So I mentioned that we have 10-year-olds. There was our algebra instructor from UC Irvine said she went into the park one day and there were a group of 10-year-olds playing, and they came and said, "Oh, you're the Coursera lady. It's so great to meet you. We're taking your algebra class," and they all hugged her. So that's one example. We have some less happy stories, I guess, of people who don't normally have access. So one example is a student who is a 17-year-old boy who's severely autistic. His name is Daniel, and he has been in special ed his entire life. I should say he has a speaking vocabulary of about 150 words, but he types on an iPad and is able to communicate very effectively with a very rich vocabulary. And he was the star student in the University of Pennsylvania Modern Contemporary American Poetry class. And he says this is the first meaningful educational experience that he's had after a life of special ed.
What's another example?
Yeah. So a couple months ago, we got an email from a woman who happens to be a Stanford alumna and has stage 4 breast cancer. And she says that she can't really leave the house except to go to the hospital to get her chemotherapy, and that this class is her one window into the outside world. Hmm. We have one of our earliest story is a father of an immune-suppressed baby who couldn't leave the house because his baby was getting immune treatment therapy, and he was bone marrow transplant, and he was afraid that if he would leave the house, he would bring in germs to infect her. And so he spent the time while there taking some of our courses and learning more about computer science, and ultimately ended up getting an internship in a database company on the strength of that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, an online education company launched in April 2012. Its goal is to provide the global public with access to a university-level education that has previously been unavailable on a wide scale. Coursera has partnerships with more than 60 global universities, including Stanford, Northwestern, University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Tokyo. Some people look at the disruption of the online education space and draw the analogy or the parallel to journalism and newspapers, how you had all this valuable content that was being undercut when digitalization came. Journalists' skilled work was being given away for free. And what do you see as a parallel industry or a parallel disruption?
So I think that digitalization is something that transforms an industry. It creates new leaders and it creates new job categories and opens doors that were closed before. So let's take, for example, electronic commerce. Certainly, it created a consolidation of a number of key marketplaces like Amazon and eBay, where a lot of sellers are now congregating together with a lot of buyers to create a marketplace that is actually very efficient. In some ways, it enabled things that were local mom-and-pop shops that were that had only a very small local audience, if they were efficient and forward-thinking, to all of a sudden reach out to people around the country. So when we were redoing our kitchen, I ended up buying a bunch of doorknobs from a mom-and-pop shop in Florida. So I think that this really creates opportunities as it also transforms the entire sector.
We're talking about disruption, and we're so at the early stages, it's hard to know what the long-term impacts of some of these are. But we have cell phone usage that is rampant. What changes are going on even biologically with our brain circuitry, you know, as a result of our usage of social media all the time? And I wonder if are the changes in our brains, are if those changes are making online education perhaps maybe not better distribution platforms than traditional education, but have you thought about that marriage?
Well, I think that there's a lot of changes that are occurring in today's young people that make this, in many ways, a better dissemination platform for them.
For better or worse.
For better or worse. So I think the fact that people are so used to consumption of content via digital media is making them much more open to getting content in this way. And the fact that we're able to make that content sort of shorter time span, much more intensive, much more interactive, is a lot more commensurate with how they react to other content in their lives. At the same time, I think we're also leveraging on the fact that they're used to getting so much of their interaction via digital media. I have two daughters. They're 8 and 10. They sit in adjacent rooms texting each other. They could play together physically, but they like texting each other. They like texting me. So I think that people today are actually much more receptive and interested in participating with each other via digital media, and we're capitalizing on that.
You are acquiring a lot of data. You're seeing how people are learning. What are some interesting nuggets of information that you've gleaned from the number of people taking these courses? Whether you've incorporated this feedback into the company is another matter.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest opportunities that we have here is to take the study of human learning and turn it from an anecdotal science into a data science, because the amount and quality of the data that we're getting is just unbelievable. So you can start to look at, for example, which are effective mechanisms for pedagogy in an online format and which aren't. So, for example, in collaboration with a group at Stanford, we tested the question of whether showing the instructor's face in the video is a good good thing or a bad thing. There's people who say that it distracts from the content and people that say that it humanizes the experience. And I wish I could tell you what worked better, but I can't, because the students who weren't seeing the instructor's face complained bitterly that they were unable to focus because it wasn't sufficiently engaging. And so the experiment had to be stopped in the middle. So I think that at least here is something where we know what the students think they want. If it's actually more effective, I don't know, but it's certainly what the students think they want.
What's another example?
So a very preliminary example that we did is, does sending students email telling them that a deadline is tomorrow and that they better log on and do their homework, does that increase or decrease student retention? You would think that it would increase student retention. It turns out that the answer is a little bit more nuanced. If you just send students an email telling them that their homework is due tomorrow, they feel like they're being nagged, and it actually decreases retention. The email needs to be much more carefully constructed with something that tells them not only that their homework due, but they're really doing well in the course, they're 80% along in the course, and kind of something that encourages them at the same time.
The global footprint of Coursera is vast, but can you break that down? Can you provide some more stories?
When my class was first offered on Coursera, I got an email from a student who lives on the Afghan-Pakistani border in a war zone, who told me that he had to leave school after a year to go support his family, but he really wanted to take my class and was wondering if I could offer him a scholarship. And I told him that I didn't need to offer him a scholarship because it was free. And he said, "Really? So can I take two classes?" And I said that, yes, of course he could take two classes. And then he wrote me back to say that he promises to repay my faith in him by going down to the internet cafe in his village, which is the only place that he has an internet connection, so that he would be able to do his homework every week. So that's one example. We have a student in Kazakhstan who took a number of our courses and ended up, on the strength of that, being able to get a job at Twitter in Kazakhstan. He's now working remotely. We have a group of students in Iran who, you know, there's serious network connectivity issues there. Not everyone has access to the internet. So my colleague Andrew Ng was told by one student that the student was downloading all of his lectures and burning them on DVDs to distribute them to people around the country so they would have access to lecture material, for example, even if they didn't have internet access.
What about in Ohio or someplace in the United States?
Yeah. There's a group in Ohio that has formed where a wonderful, wonderful woman took a group of students who by and large had very little college education but had a lot of motivation. And she put them together in a community center. They met once a week and they took the University of Virginia Darden course on Grow to Greatness. And she sent me a picture of the group. And, you know, it's people by and large in their 40s who've had a very difficult life. They work all the time and yet they carve time out of their schedule to try and learn something new and become and have a better life as a consequence of that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers university-level online courses to the global public. Coursera is one of a number of companies offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that had been launched in recent years to address a growing global population and the rising costs of on-campus higher education. You are from Israel, and you come from a family of academics. Your father was a botanist, and your mother taught English as a second language. I'm kind of curious about your father's botany. Do you have an interest in botany?
No, I don't. I think my father was disappointed that neither of his children expressed an interest in botany. But interestingly, my father's story is that he really wanted to be an engineer. And he even started out studying to be an engineer, but he was told at the time, Israel is a very young country, that the thing Israel needed most was not engineers, but rather agriculture. So he went from being an engineer to being to working in botany, which is the basis for Israeli agriculture. But I think throughout his life, he was a bit of a frustrated engineer, and the part that he enjoyed as much as anything was building all sorts of cool measurement devices for his plants. And so I think that in retrospect, my father and I had a lot more parallels than our different paths in life suggested.
Right. Israel, obviously,'s land is quite arid, and they've had to be very resourceful in growing its food. And
that's right. But I think the funny part is that now, of course, Israel's biggest industry is, in fact, its engineering and high-tech industry, and my father was just born at the wrong time.
Did you serve in the Israeli army?
Yes, I did. I was a lieutenant in military intelligence.
This was in the 1980s? Or
yes.
Did you read Startup Nation and how Israel is more entrepreneurial because of the military experience that they have?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, Israel is more entrepreneurial because of the military experience. I think it takes young people and puts them into a position where they have a really significant mission that they're trying to live up to. It's resource constrained, and you're supposed to make do with what's available. You take a person and say, you have to do this. There isn't much money. There isn't a lot of equipment for you to do it with, but do it anyway.
What's an example of that resourcefulness?
The examples that I know are all classified. Sorry.
You are the Rajiv Motwani Professor of Computer Science at Stanford, and Rajiv was an advisor to a number of startups in Silicon Valley, including Google. Actually, Google endowed this professorship.
Endowed chair.
After Professor Motwani died, did you have interactions with Professor Motwani when you were...
Professor Motwani was actually on the faculty at Stanford when I joined as a graduate student back in 1989. When I came back to Stanford as faculty back in 95, we were actually in that same research group from which Larry Page and Sergey Brin emerged and created Google. It was part of the Digital Libraries group at Stanford, and a lot of the early discussions around how to rank web pages occurred in the context of that group. So I've known Larry and Sergey since they were back when they were still graduate students at Stanford. Rajiv was a tremendously gifted individual, and was, I think, one of his greatest strengths was his ability to bridge the theory and the practice. I think that was a part of his ability to help guide people like Larry and Sergey into areas that would make so much impact. And the chair that is endowed in his name is intended to be for people who similarly bridge between theory and practice. And I'm very privileged to be able to hold that chair. It's a real honor.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera. Coming up, we'll meet Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full-body workout. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. For having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also, and so I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, oh, you know, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago, and I ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jinshin Jitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in L.A. for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day, and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby, and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born, and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How, you know, how old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, well, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced, and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a, you know, a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and,
right,
you know,
what
Bill's
was
class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk a little bit about the music, and really, there's a DJ component to it?
Absolutely. Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
It's Alicia Keys and Jay-Z.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street, very well located on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. Mm. And if you would like to have one, it will be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally
stolen.
The community board wanted to actually see us.
Right. And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah.
Quick.
After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling: water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it. And I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
We put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So people, we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week, and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. Or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, this is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free? They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio and he walked in and he looked around and he looked for the showers and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open, and he looked at me and he said, people really come here? And I said, yeah, people really come here, and the people that come here really like it. And I could just see him looking at my mother, desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that there are room with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Yeah. Sort of.
He's Dad. Impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But that was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe 3 or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming, you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, the New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like, you know. Beg my husband, can you watch the baby this morning? And we would sit there. And maybe if we got one or two phone calls the whole day, I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come. And people
really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial. And the
you know, 80s. I told a friend, and they told two friends,
and so on and so on and so on, and it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And
It was through a rider.
And she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride.
But he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. You know what? It was a slow news day. And everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue, and we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.